Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine welcomes Dr. Sunil Abhyankar. Dr. Abhyankar is Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and Director of Bone Marrow Transplantapheresis and Cell Processing at the University of Kansas Hospital. Here's Francine Foss.
Can you start off by telling us a little bit about your background and how you became interested in this whole area of bone marrow transplant?
Bone marrow transplant has always been on the cutting edge of oncology and treatment of cancer. So I trained University of Bombay, or Mumbai, as it is now called, and I was doing pediatric oncology there. And we saw a lot of patients with thalassemia in India, and it is quite common, it's quite prevalent in that area of the world. And the treatment for thalassemia involves transfusions every week or every 2 weeks, every month, depending upon how low the hemoglobin is. And I used to see many of these young kids who their blood banks were not, you know, adequately had all the equipment. The transfusion needs were quite high. And we always thought, you know, wouldn't it be great to have a transplant program here so that we can, cure this illness. And that's how I got interested in allogeneic bone marrow transplant, which is a donor type of bone marrow transplant. And so I came to the U.S. because this is back in 87 when transplant was not that well established in India. And I spent about 3 years at the Dana-Farber working with Dr. Jamie Ferrara, who was my kind of initial mentor. And I did research there in graft-versus-host disease with him. And then that got my interest into trying to focus on graft-versus-host disease as a field that I wanted to try to do research on and do clinical work to see how we can decrease that complication after transplant. So the originally whole my interest was trying to cure this thalassemia in pediatric or young children with this problem with transplantation.
So it's a little bit unusual for us to think about using bone marrow transplant for something other than like a leukemia or a lymphoma. Can you just let the audience know what thalassemia is for those of us who maybe haven't heard that term? And can you talk about the role of bone marrow transplant in treating those non-malignant diseases?
Absolutely. So thalassemia is a genetically inherited condition. It's a recessive inheritance. And it is first described in the Mediterranean region. So it used to be called Mediterranean anemia. And it was common in Italy and Greece. And then, as you know, India has a large, wide genetic pool because people have come to India from all over the Eastern Asia and Western Asia. So in India, there is a big population of patients who have inherited this gene. Now, this is a recessive inheritance, so you have to have a part of the defective gene inherited from the father and the other part inherited from the mother. And when the two come together in a child, then that results in a condition where the hemoglobin formation is not as effective. So the hemoglobin gets formed when the baby is born. It's a fetal hemoglobin, but as the baby gets older, the child gets older, it converts to adult hemoglobin, and the formation of adult hemoglobin is defective in this particular genetic condition. So what happens, the child becomes anemic. So typically, in a severe case of thalassemia, the parents bring the child because the child looks very pale. Happens around 4 to 6, 7 months of age. And we start testing, and then we determine that what the problem is that the baby is not making enough hemoglobin. The bone marrow has lots of cells. The cells are trying to make the hemoglobin, but because the gene is defective, the hemoglobin molecule is not formed in a proper fashion. And then that results in severe anemia. The only way you can correct that is by giving transfusion. Thalassemia is not very prevalent in this country, although it is seen, you know, if you are in the New York, northeast part where you have people who are from Mediterranean ancestry and have had, you know, you have to have two individuals who carry that gene, have offspring or have children to have the children inherit that disease. And so you do see it in the northeast. But in India, the problem is that the blood banks do not have a good source of voluntary donation, blood donations. So a typical family, let's say if they get, unfortunately, have a child with thalassemia, then they have to line up people who would be willing to donate blood for their child. And this is a lifelong process because there is no cure for this illness. So in those countries, transplanting and doing a bone marrow transplant where basically you're replacing the defective bone marrow of the patient with a healthy bone marrow from a matched individual, usually it's a sibling who's a match, will cure that inherited disease in the bone marrow. And the inheritance of the disease only affects the bone marrow. It doesn't affect anything else in that child. So the children grow well, the hemoglobin stays normal. They're very bright young kids. They have nothing else wrong with them. It's just anemia, which if not properly managed, then can cause a lot of problems. The growth is stunted, then their spleen becomes big. The liver can become big to compensate for the anemia. And then that results in multiple other problems. So the good way to manage thalassemics in this country is because we have an excellent blood bank support and the blood is screened for all infectious agents. Then in this country, the management is transfusions to maintain a hemoglobin around 9 or so, 10 in that range. And then that will prevent the child having the chronic effects of chronic anemia, which would include stunting and all the physical effects that go with chronic anemia.
So we typically think about bone marrow transplant in the context of adults, but you're coming at it from a pediatric point of view. Can you talk a little bit about what the differences are between adults and children in terms of the whole process of bone marrow transplantation and the success of the procedure?
Yes, and I forgot to answer one of the previous points in your previous question is, typically in adults, we are using the transplant for treatment of malignant or cancer conditions, but there are a lot of non-malignant conditions for which we do bone marrow transplant as well, and many of these are in children. So one I mentioned is a thalassemia. There is some evidence that in some patients with sickle cell anemia, they can benefit if it's done in the right context, in the right patient population, the right donor. Similarly, there are inherited immune disorders. The only way you can cure those is by replacing the bone marrow stem cell from a healthy donor. Then there's another condition which can be acquired, which is called aplastic anemia, where the patient's bone marrow doesn't make any cells, white cells, red cells, platelets. And sometimes this does not respond to manage suppressing the immune system. And if you have a well-matched donor, then we would do a bone marrow transplant with a very good success rate. So those are the non-malignant conditions for which bone marrow transplant can be done in brief. But getting back to your next question about what is a major difference between adults and children when we do transplantation for these inherited diseases or these acquired cancers, conditions. The major difference is that in children, they seem to recover better from all the chemo that we use to do the transplant. So when somebody undergoes a bone marrow transplant, by the way, the word bone marrow transplant is often interchangeably used with stem cell transplant because the stem cells that we collect to do the transplant come from the bone marrow. So we can either get the stem cells from the bone marrow physically, or we can get these stem cells from the peripheral blood by making these stem cells come out from the bone marrow into the blood and then harvesting it from the blood. So the words can be interchangeably used sometimes. But the main way we have to do the transplant is first we have to give a big dose of chemotherapy, sometimes combined with a big dose of radiation, so that the whatever condition that the patient has, whether it's a leukemia or if it is a non-malignant immune defect, then you want to suppress or kill some of those bad or defective immune cells, just as you want to kill the bad cancer cells that might be in the bone marrow. So often we end up using intense regimen of chemo and radiation, and that's followed by infusion of the bone marrow or the infusion of the stem cells that have been obtained from the blood. So children are able to tolerate these treatments. They recover faster than adults. As we get older, our ability to tolerate these more intense chemo regimens goes down, and children recover faster from that. There is also a complication called graft versus host disease, where the donor cells attack the recipient. So it's like opposite of rejection. In rejection, the patient rejects the donor stem cells. But in a graft versus host disease, the donor cells begin to attack the patient's tissues because they realize that they're in a different body, even though the donor and the patient are well matched. And that's called graft versus host disease. That complication is much less in the pediatric age group. And as we get older, now more and more we're doing transplants in 70 and 75-year-old people. And in that situation, we see that there is a much higher risk of graft versus host disease. So overall, children recover faster from the bone marrow transplant. The cure rates of some of these diseases is higher in children than in adults, mainly because they can recover. The immune system is a little bit more naive as compared to the older immune system, older person's immune system, and therefore they seem to have less complications. But getting a child through a transplant is a pretty intense process, and that's because you have to deal with a young mind and young child who may not completely understand what is going on. And it involves a lot of support from the parents. It involves a lot of support from social services, child psychologists, play therapists. And you need to have a very dedicated team and dedicated group of individuals. It's not just the physician. The physician's role is quite small in actually doing this process. You have to have a big team to help this child get through the transplant and help the family get through the transplant.
I imagine at the University of Kansas that you're a regional center and that patients travel from very far to get to your center, unlike the Northeast where we have many centers. Can you talk about what the experience is like for a patient, how they get there, how long they're in the hospital, and what happens when they get discharged?
Yes, a very, very good point. You're absolutely right, because transplant is not something that is being done in the community centers, and it should not be done in a community center, obviously. Patients do come from far away. So in the Kansas City area where we are located, we get patients from all the way from western Kansas, which is about 400 miles away. We are very lucky because we have like a bed and breakfast or kind of a place that is run by the American Cancer Society. And patients who come from far away can stay there free of charge for almost 100 days for the duration of the transplant. So typically when patients come from far away, we expect them that they stay in the area around 10-15 mile radius for about 100 days post-transplant, so we can watch them for complications.
We're going to have to take a break right now for a short medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about bone marrow transplant with Dr. Abhyankar.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year and nearly 200,000 nationwide. But there is new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2010, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and today I'm joined by my guest, Dr. Sunil Abhyankar. We're here discussing bone marrow transplantation, and we've talked a little bit in the first half of the show about pediatric bone marrow transplantation, particularly for non-malignant diseases such as thalassemia. However, most of our patients, at least in the adult setting, have various kinds of leukemias or lymphomas. You touched a little bit on some of the differences in children. Can you just briefly talk about some of the differences between a patient with leukemia and lymphoma getting a transplant versus, say, a child who's otherwise well with sickle cell anemia or thalassemia? Is the transplant more complicated, and are there more complications as a result of the process?
Yeah, so those two groups of diagnosis are quite different when we approach how we do the transplant. So, for instance, if you have a child with thalassemia or sickle cell who doesn't have a underlying, there's no malignancy or cancerous condition involved, it's a genetically inherited defect in the red blood cells, and often that child has been transfused to keep up their hemoglobin. And when somebody gets multiple transfusions, then that iron that is there in the blood of the transfused blood can accumulate over time. And this iron gets deposited in our tissues. It gets deposited in the liver, in the heart, and other other areas. And that can cause serious problems. So before we take somebody to transplant for conditions like thalassemia or sickle cell anemia, we have to estimate how much iron overload that person has, and that because that can significantly impact what the outcome of the transplant is. The other issue is every time we transfuse somebody with blood, there's a risk that that person develops antibodies to the different red blood cell antigens and can get sensitized to different red blood products, red blood cell products. And then this can create a situation where there is a higher risk of rejection of the stem cells from the donor. Whereas when you look at a condition where there in an adult, let's say with a leukemia or a lymphoma, and you're looking at doing a donor type of transplant, not an autologous transplant where we're taking the person's own stem cells, but taking a stem cell from a donor, then that is a really different situation. In a situation where there's leukemia or lymphoma, there is some urgency going into transplant. We need to work up the patient quickly. We need to identify the donor quickly. And our research done in this country has shown that many times what happens, unfortunately, is that the right donor is not found in the right time. And if you look at the statistics of how many people actually need to undergo transplant versus actually how many people undergo transplant, there is quite a gap. And that gap is because we cannot find the right donor, or if the right donor is found, the donor is not being able to donate the stem cells in the right time that is needed. So often what can happen as you're waiting for the donor to materialize, a patient may relapse and the cancer may come back. And now we're giving other therapies to try to put the cancer in remission before we do a transplant. So the complete different approach, if you have a non-malignant condition like thalassemia, sickle cell, as compared to a malignant conditions where there is more urgency. Also in a malignant, there is more exposure to chemotherapy that this person has had before they get to transplant. So the transplant-related complications that occur because of exposure to chemotherapy, we see more in that particular group than in the other group, where they have not been exposed to any kind of chemotherapy before we undergo the transplant process.
So, Sunil, the best donor obviously would be a sibling who identically matches the patient, but as you said, we don't find that often. Can you talk about some of the alternative types of donors that we're using now and how successful those transplants are?
Absolutely. And so the chance that one of our siblings is a match is about 25%. And this is simple Mendelian genetics. So 25% chance that a sibling will match, 75% chance that the person does not have a match in the family. So in that situation, we have to look for donors through either through the donor registry. But the more exciting thing that is happening over the last few years is the availability of umbilical cord blood and the ability to do transplant using umbilical cord blood. So getting back to the donor registry, the donor registry is run by the National Marrow Donor Program. And the National Marrow Donor Program in this country is linked to the donor registries in Europe and other countries around the world, so that there are about 13 or 14 million people in all these registries who have registered to volunteer to be a donor for somebody who needs a transplant. So if it is common that if a patient's brother or sister does not match, and that a patient happens to have a Caucasian ancestry or a mostly European ancestry, that we are able to find a donor through these 13, 14 million donors, and almost 70% chance that we may find a donor through the donor registry. But if, on the other hand, the patient ancestry is not Caucasian or European, but is a mixture from India, let's say like me, the chance that somebody like me may find a donor through the donor registry is quite small. I heard a statistic in one of our bone marrow transplant meeting that to find a donor for a person with a Caucasian background, you need to screen about 20,000 people. Whereas for somebody with an Indian, East Indian background, or even American Indian probably background, you need to probably screen 80,000 people of that ethnicity. And that's because there is more genetic diversity in people who have come from India. Also, just similarly, there's more genetic diversity in people of African-American descent. And therefore, it gets very hard to find a donor for that person with who we would call a minority in this country to be able to find a donor through a donor registry. They have higher genetic diversity, and also the number of people who are volunteering to be on the donor registry is small in these communities. So in this situation, there is exciting research now and clinical research showing that umbilical cord blood can be used to successfully do the transplant. And cord blood banks around the country have been banking cord blood now for many years, and they have now big stores of cord blood. So what can happen? A person needs transplant for leukemia. Let's say they are of East Indian descent. We cannot find a sibling match. We do not have a donor through the National Marrow Donor Program. We quickly look at the cord blood and what cord bloods are available. The advantage of cord blood is that you can successfully do the transplant even with a mismatch situation. So normally when you do a transplant, you have to match a different human leukocyte antigen locations on the DNA. We call them HLA. Or to use another word, the tissue type. So we have to match at 8 different locations on the DNA, and we say a person has a perfect match when they have an 8 out of 8 match. Whereas when you look at the umbilical cord blood, you don't have to have a perfect 8 out of 8 match. In the cord blood situation, we're looking at 6 different locations on the DNA, and these are at A, B, and DR. So in a cord blood, you could have only 4 out of those 6 matches and be able to do a successful transplant. So the choice of donors is now, because of availability of cord blood, is increasing. Similarly, haploidentical transplants also being done more frequently. Haploidentical means half match. So let's say somebody has a sibling who's not a match, but all of us will have half match siblings. If our brother or sister is not a complete match genetically, with us for purpose of the transplant, there will at least be a 4 out of 6 or a 3 out of 6 match. In that situation, we can use a sibling donor if we have a haploidentical program or a protocol to be able to do this transplant. These are still being done under research studies, so this is not something that is yet mainstream. But cord blood and haploidentical transplants will expand the donor availability, especially for people who have what we would call ethnic minority in this country.
The major complications as you get more and more mismatched are graft versus host disease, as you touched on earlier. Can you talk a little bit about the management of graft versus host disease and some of the new things that you've been working with?
So yeah, graft versus host disease is one of the, as you mentioned, rightly mentioned, the major complication of bone marrow or a stem cell transplant from a donor. And this happens because the donor's immune system recognizes that they are in a foreign body and begin attacking different tissues. So typically when graft versus host disease occurs, the tissues that are involved are the skin, the GI system, the liver, and in the long-term situation, it can also attack other organs like the musculoskeletal system, the lungs, and other tissues. So this can, graft versus host disease can be pretty devastating. And therefore, when we do transplant, we try our best to try and limit the amount of graft versus host disease that occurs. We don't want to completely get rid of graft versus host disease, because what we know from research is that a little bit of graft versus host disease is beneficial, because when the donor's immune system fights the patient, it also fights the patient's cancer. And therefore, we want a little bit of graft versus host disease, but we don't want it to go out of control. So if you were to look at just the incidence of graft versus host disease, it can vary anywhere from 50% to 70% of the time after the transplant. And it all depends upon how well is the match between the donor and the patient, how old is the donor, how old is the patient, and then certain other things like infections, like CMV, which can contribute to development of graft-versus-host disease. So 50 to 70% chance that somebody may end up with GVHD. So we, after we do the transplant, we have to use medications, immunosuppressive drugs, to prevent this complication if we can. And then if it does happen, then we have to treat it. The mainstay of treatment of GVHD is the use of prednisone. And as you, many of you may know, prednisone is a drug that is a very good drug to treat many immune disorders and also GVHD, but there's a lot of side effects, tremendous side effects causing diabetes, hypertension, muscle weakness, osteoporosis, and many others. So the research has been focusing on trying to limit how much prednisone we need to give to somebody who develops graft versus host disease. And there are many other agents that have been tried. The one that I am particularly interested in is not really an agent, but is a therapy called photopheresis, where patient's white blood cells get exposed, are collected in a special machine, and they get exposed to ultraviolet light in the presence of a drug which is called a photosensitizer. And what happens then is that the photosensitizer drug in the presence of UV light damages some of the DNA in some of the cells, and when these cells get infused back into the patient, then they set up a process whereby we generate what we call immune tolerance. That means the generation of tolerance between the donor's immune system and the recipient or the patient's tissues and immune system. And
Go ahead. So I was just going to ask you how well this whole treatment works and how successful it is.
We would like it to be more successful, and unfortunately it is not, there is no panacea in the treatment of GVHD or preventing GVHD. But it does work when somebody has graft versus host disease. It does work about 30 to 50% of the time. And the advantage of this particular treatment is that we have very few side effects. And therefore, somebody undergoing GVHD treatment may be successful. And if this treatment is working, we can successfully wean or taper off the other immunosuppressive drugs.
Dr. Sunil Abhyankar is Associate Professor of Medicine and Pediatrics and Director of Bone Marrow Transplant Pheresis and Cell Processing at the University of Kansas Hospital. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.